The following Dharma talk was given at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
One of the causes of insight is merely paying attention, paying closer attention to what we're experiencing. When we were talking about doing eating meditation and paying attention to that whole process from beginning to end, and even just paying attention to one bite from beginning to end. So I'm curious if anyone had any insights arise during lunchtime? Any reflections? Anything come up?
I don't usually eat so mindfully, but I appreciated the tastes. Partly it's really good food, but the unique taste of each thing started coming through in a different way. So it was, I felt like I was unpacking the experience of eating.
Right.
Yeah. It was, yeah, much more enjoyable.
Yeah, kudos to all those that cooked food or that shopped for your choices. That was good food. I was thinking that a potluck and a buffet is kind of like the Black Diamond run of mindfulness, basically. Rather than if you just had one big thing in front of you, you could focus from beginning to end. You know, it's kind of endless novelty on your plate, and you kind of have to try to escape that. But I was kind of thinking about, you know, have you ever fed table scraps to a dog, like a steak to a dog? Like, you would never feed steak to a dog because they don't seem to appreciate it, right? They just, oh, and their tails wag, and clearly they liked it, but they didn't savor it. They're not thinking about their taxes or if they, you know, sent out that last work email. A dog is pretty mindful just sort of inherently. You know, what's the difference between mindfulness, I guess, and sort of savoring the moment? Like, where do you draw that line between kind of focus and, you know, get what I'm saying?
Roof.
Yeah. I mean, I could have done that to every little, I had about a bite's worth on my plate of everything, and I could have just gone, whoop. Total focus, but I'm not sure that's exactly enlightenment.
Right. Well, this is all good observation, because say if we're more mindful, if we're paying attention to what we're eating, we may notice the flavors more, and we may enjoy it more. We may realize that, oh, a lot of our eating in the past has, we've been missing it, missing out on a lot of the enjoyment of it, because while we could be paying attention to the tastes, we're actually thinking about something else. You know, we're thinking about something else, we're conversing, hardly any mindfulness, hardly any awareness is going into the actual experience. And especially when so much work goes into the food, all the shopping, the expense, the cooking, the cleaning up afterwards, and then we don't pay attention to it, it's like kind of stupid. You know, at least pay attention to it, and then we, you know, we can appreciate what we're doing. Then there's the aspect of when we really pay attention to it, close attention to the whole process, there is the deliciousness, the gratification, and then there's a lot of process of eating that is actually kind of boring as well. Right, where the mind starts to wander, you know, as soon as it's not like a burst of flavor, then very easily the mind's thinking about something else, get distracted, looking at something else, want to turn on some media, look at our phone, have a conversation, right? So if we just are with the entire process of eating, like for me today, I was really, it's just burst of flavor, and then the rest is just kind of boring, chewing. Like one bite. The first part is quite delicious. And then kind of chewing gets a bit boring. There's still a little flavor, but not much. It's just kind of chewing, kind of boring. And by the end, it's just kind of tedious. Can't quite swallow it yet, but it's kind of tedious. All right, let's get that bite out of the way. Get on to the next one. Kind of like relationships. It's delicious, boring, tedious, look for the next one. So, I assume.
You gotta write a book about relationships, I'll tell you.
You'd be surprised how many people come to me for relationship guidance. Yeah. So then there's the aspect of, now you can use mindfulness to pay closer attention to what we're doing, and then we notice that the things which are pleasant, we can actually enjoy them more. But the purpose of mindfulness is not merely to experience things fully, but it's also to bring wisdom to bear to it. So those things which are pleasant, we notice as a pleasant, and that's just a natural outcome. You know, we have a pleasant reaction to something. It's neither positive nor negative, or neither wholesome nor unwholesome. But then, very quickly, it can go into the next step of, if it's delicious, I would like more of it. How can I have this in the future? How can I hold on to this? How can I make sure that, you know, attachment starts to set in? So mindfulness can be used to increase attachment to something that we're doing, the savoring aspect of it. So it's like paying attention to every form of deliciousness, and it actually increases sensual desire or increases attachment to the food. So that, again, that's something like noticing there's the pleasant aspect, neutral, unpleasant, and then trying to stick with that. Yes? Paying attention, well, first of all, when I say boring, what is boring? Boring is just something we project, right? If we have a slight aversion to something, not exciting enough, then we call it boring. Really, that's just an interpretation. But often people have the experience of, you know, once the flavor's gone, you're still chewing, chewing, chewing. You know, if you're not looking for the next bite, it feels like, all right, let's move on. Insight comes from seeing things just as they are. So with eating, we may have a perception of the food, and the perception is the main thing that we're actually consuming. For example, you may have a perception of pizza, and then that motivates us to go get a pizza. And visually, it may reinforce that perception, but the actual taste of the pizza might not live up to that perception. Usually, it doesn't live up to the perception. It's not as good as the perception. And that's when the mind will start to wander, huh? Because we're relying on that perception and the gratification of that perception to keep fueling our desires, sensual desires. So when we actually pay attention, okay, well, this is okay, we got our pizza. It's okay, you know. Especially the first part when we're hungry, you know, it tends to be quite gratifying. But then it's okay, but then there's this a good portion of it which after that it's not as exciting. And if we really pay attention to that, then we start to see things in perspective, and the glorification of that concept or that perception is diminished, or it becomes more realistic. Instead of thinking, "Hell, if I get a pizza, then I'm going to be happy," right? It's more like, "Yeah, pizzas can be pleasant, but it's just pizza," right? So we start to see these. We start to modify our perceptions, so they become closer and closer to reality. Many of our perceptions tend to be either unrealistically positive or unrealistically negative. And so when we start to see things just as they are, then we come closer to reality. And then it becomes easier to let go of things. Because we can't force ourselves to let go. We talk a lot about letting go of attachment in Buddhism. No one can force themselves to let go of things. What we can do is to see things as close as we can to as they actually are, And then in that process in and of itself, you know, our natural wisdom kicks in. And then we see, oh, well, that's, yeah, that's okay, but it only offers that much pleasure, right? You know, things off, pizza offers a certain amount of pleasure, but it's not that much pleasure, right? It's like, oh, okay, it's like, it's kind of like that, right? And then it's not such a big deal anymore. Right, right. So whether our experience is pleasant or unpleasant, pay attention to all of it. Our attention tends to be drawn to the extremes when something is very pleasant or very unpleasant. And that gives us a skewed perception of our experience. So trying to even out our mindfulness so that we pay attention to not just the obvious things, but also the more subtle things, the ordinary things, and particularly notice the places where our minds tend to wander. Like there's some things that it's for some reason it's just difficult for us to look at that, right? And our mind, we're always looking for a distraction. So why is that? Why is it difficult to look in some areas? And so if we really, really try moment by moment to pay attention and just notice, oh, mind's wandering now. And then we notice, now every time I come to this particular action or this particular part of an action, my mind tends to wander. Why is that? Right? And so really try to pay attention to that. And then suddenly maybe some old trauma bubbles up, or you know, some insight happens. Say, ah. So just maintaining a continuity. Yeah, the instructions aren't that difficult, but maintaining a continuity, an even consistent continuity of awareness, is quite challenging.
I noticed in this eating that, you know, the greed, aversion, and delusion arise endlessly. and I just noticed, you know, as I was in line, I was thinking, oh, my God, I hope there's one of those chocolates are left. And so the greed kicked in, and then when I was eating one dish, you know, aversion rose up because I thought, you know, the way that person made this is a little different than I would, and it's not, you know, quite my thing. And, you know, the next thing I noticed is, when the food was on the table, it was just food. But when it's on my plate, oh, now it's my food.
Right.
But the question I have is about the origin of those things, because, you know, I think a lot of it is learned behavior, but a lot of it is kind of, you know, we're animals, and some of it is, you know, kind of hardwired into us. And, you know, there's even studies now that plants have aversion and grasping. Just a whole bunch of things came up this week in the literature. So my question is, if it's a learned behavior, obviously we can potentially unlearn it, but that intrinsic grasping and aversion and to a great degree delusion that's intrinsic to us just being an animal, at that point, do we just accept it and watch it, or do you think that there's even a possibility of some freedom from just that basic animal instinct?
Yes, observe and accept all of it. But even what you're referring to as hardwired or animal-based desires and reactions, that too is modifiable. Nothing is unchangeable. And even the most basic forms of say, my food, that's all overcome. I mean, we have the ability to do much better than that. We don't have to be stuck at that level. It's not something that, you know, we accept it in the sense that that's where we are now. But we don't have to accept that it's always going to be this way. But it is interesting to see, isn't it? As soon as it's in our plate, right, how quickly identification goes, possessiveness, mine, and then how quickly things can become complicated. You know, it's just food going into our tongue, and then we think pleasant, unpleasant, the whole history of when I do it this way, or even if we take something that was quite delicious, like there wasn't a lot of, if there were cakes and ice creams You think, instead of just enjoying the pleasantness of it, how quickly the mind could go into guilt, you know, whole stories about should I be eating this, should I not be eating this, and then we don't even get to enjoy, you know, we don't even get to have the experience of the simple pleasure of the moment. So yeah, it's good just to see how something very simple like eating can quickly become complicated.
I had an interesting look at the watermelon today. So I don't know who brought that, but it was amazing. And it went from like red swirls with or red with like white swirls, and then as I ate it, it went away, and then it became like green with white. And as I was eating it, I thought, well, where's the end of the watermelon? Because I couldn't figure out where the watermelon ended. And so I kept eating, and then I just thought, well, this is so funny. Everybody tells you to stop at the red, but, like, the rest of it was edible, too.
Did like you, like, eat the whole rind?
Some of it, yeah. it wasn't as good as the red, right. But... it was pretty yummy.
Well, yeah, it brings up the whole question of if something is delicious or not. I mean, why do we eat? Do we eat? We only eat what we eat because it's delicious, or we think it's healthy, or because someone has told us. It's a learned behavior that we eat this, but we don't eat that. Yeah, I mean, I've seen some people... You know, I just would never have the concept of eating an orange rind, an orange skin. And then I've seen some people eat an orange skin. I think that's wrong. You know, the thought arises, that's unusual, or that's wrong. Well, why? Why? It's just because I haven't seen it before.
Well, and it really struck me that... you know, right now my husband and I are sort of going down in income, and not to say we have to eat watermelon rinds, but it really struck me, it was so fibrous and so nutritious that if somebody were really hungry, there's a whole part of the watermelon that's not really used, but it's very, right. It's yeah. Very good. So I just noticed that. Thanks.
When I noticed when you kind of had said, you know, things when we're eating can kind of correlate to other things in our life as well. So paying attention really to the whole entire bite for me was a good practice. It kind of helped me realize that, I mean, lots of different tasks that I complete in my life, you know, washing the dishes, when I'm drying the last dish, usually I'm focused on, okay, well, what's coming next, you know, what's coming next type deal. So it was just very beneficial to kind of pay attention, and a helpful reminder to really be present through whole activities before reaching outward and on.
I noticed they didn't put walnuts in my salad. So it was, well, I had this salad to go, and it was like, where are my walnuts? And I go, they've done this before to me. But then I just said, you can enjoy your salad without the walnuts.
I think it's probably a conspiracy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Probably intentional. Personal.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's funny when you expect something, how your mind can kind of go to...
Absolutely. Yeah. I know. Simplest little thing.
Yeah.
Instead of it's, just noticing that it's not there. That's what we call mental proliferation, because, you know, you just start with something very simple. We notice it's not there. Why? And within a few seconds, a whole story can come up.
Last time they didn't put my chicken in there.
Yeah. I tell you, it is a conspiracy.
I'm Don, and What resonated with me was you were making the connection between food and how we live our life. And that I never made that connection with eating. And it was like opening up like a floodgate. I'm not quite sure, you know, it was just a lot of thoughts that came up and just a new experience around that. And I'm going to think more about that when I eat, how I live my life.
Actually, I had the same thing. When you said that, I mean, just watch how I eat. And I ever since I start practicing, I definitely notice I have this stronger version and then a high attachment to what I like. And I put all the food when I was picking food, and then the peaches looked very delicious. So I was like, oh, because I really like peach and plum sticks, stuff like that. And I noticed that peach is the first thing that I ate. And then I finished the whole thing before I eat anything else. But then I noticed that, wow, this is just like how I live my life. I only do what I like and don't even touch what I don't like. And then I noticed, okay, I'm going to leave a couple of peaches and I'm gonna eat other stuff. And I had this food, I had a one bite, and it just wasn't what I expected and didn't like the taste. And I automatically grabbed peach, and I stopped eating the one that I didn't like the taste of it, and I noticed how even without like any thought involved, just automatically grabbed peach. That's really how kind of I respond to things. That sometimes I have bad experience, I just try to find like online whatever like what I like and just cover it up with what I like, you know, normally. So that was amazing insight. Thank you.
So I noticed that sometimes the next bite would be ready to go on my fork before I had finished chewing and swallowing the food that was in my mouth, and I became curious about that. And the first thought was, oh, well, it's because the food is obviously delicious and you just want more of it. But there was something in the mind that thought, well, is that true? Is that totally what's going on here? And so I discovered that actually there was an aversion to the process of the stomach filling up with food. That there was an aversion initially to the stomach being hungry. That was okay to the mind. But as soon as it got a little full, that's when it didn't become okay. It wanted to become full, and then it would be satisfied. And so it kind of became this game, like I would take a bite, and then I would say, like, okay, can this level of fullness be okay right now, the way it is? Can this be okay? And there was a lot of resistance to that. So I took another bite. Can this level of fullness now be okay? And I just kind of watched, you know, the aversion increase and decrease throughout the course of the meal until eventually it went away when the stomach was full. So that was really fascinating to observe.
Hello.
Oh, yeah. So what I noticed when you first were talking about mindful eating was, like, I was just kind of laughing because, like, I'm the worst at this. You know, it was just like that was how my mind immediately went, like, oh, I'm just the worst at mindful eating. And, you know, it's almost like a joke or something. And then I was just reflecting on that. It's like I kind of have this, like, negative self-image. Like, I think, like, I'm a bad Buddhist. I'm a bad meditator. You know, when I was younger, I used to have depression and low self-esteem. I don't really get dragged down by those things now. I'm just kind of like, yeah, I just kind of suck at this, but I'm doing it anyway. It's fun. It's cool. But then for a moment, I was like, what if I actually developed, like, a positive self-image around this? What if I thought, well, I could be good at mindful eating? That's like the next level. Not there yet, but that's all.
You've alluded to this, but I noticed that eating or anything you're doing is an anchor, much like we use the breath, to the present moment and to our bodies and to our minds. And it's a way to connect us to the present moment and not get off into proliferation of thoughts and stories. The other thing that occurred to me was taste is perception. For example, I may like chocolate and thinking, wow, you know, I perceive this as awesome. My daughter hates chocolate. So, you know, it gets into that whole perception thing again.
Exactly. And we tend to assume that our perceptions are shared by other people. Even if when we think about it, we see it's not. But you know, something like taste of food, it becomes more clear. You know, it's like, oh, if we experience this as delicious, then somehow we project an innate deliciousness in it, which it doesn't naturally have. It has a combination of molecules and elements that we experience with a positive feeling, but those same molecules and elements on someone else's tongue, someone else's personal history, may have a negative experience or a neutral experience or a positive experience in a different way. And even something very simple like that is how individual our perceptions are and how that creates a reality and how we project it out.
I have a question that came up when we talked about food is mine. And I think I saw this in the birds actually on the walk outside too. One of them grabbed something from the air and the others crowded around and he sort of moved. And, you know, so we have this sort of ability to imagine what, you know, what we like and go for it. And it becomes ours. And, you know, I'm curious because that circle of desires is not always seen as the end goal in Buddhism, as far as I understand. So I am curious about, instead of that being the major driving motivator for creating goals or what you want to happen and manifest in this world, what is a more, I don't know if pure is the right word, but a better way to approach the creation of good in this world or the creation of desires, goals, motivations, rather than just that simple sort of, I want this. I see it. I want it. What's a more, right. Yeah.
Well, it can start with simply what we were talking about earlier, noticing the wholesome and the unwholesome. And if we're dedicated to developing the wholesome, we start to notice that, oh, it is more satisfying, tends to increase a sense of meaning in life. However, you know, meaning is something else that we project onto life, but generally people can feel life is more meaningful if we're dedicated to developing the wholesome. Personal relationships generally start to become closer, more harmonious. Greater trust in relationships if we're developing the wholesome. It's easier to see benefit for oneself, benefit for society. Positive or helpful ripples start to go out from our life. We start to notice that a bit more when we're dedicated to the wholesome. So those are some, you know, those are some changes that we can see that are well within our ability, even on relatively early stages of the path. And then, of course, that's all kind of leading towards greater and greater purification of the citta, or greater purification of the mind, with even more powerful ripple effect. So just to remind people, enlightened people still eat. The Buddha still ate. And the Buddha still experienced delicious tastes, but he viewed food more as medicine. He would talk about it more in terms of it's just healthy for the body. We reflect. We have a food reflection that we do in the monasteries that comes from the time of the Buddha, comes from the suttas. And reflecting, you know, is this, we're not eating merely for the pleasure of it, we're not eating just to put on weight or to make our bodies beautiful. We're eating because we need to alleviate hunger. We need to have strength to continue on living so that we can practice the Dhamma. So it kind of changes our way of approaching things. You know, we may still experience the pleasant deliciousness of it, but then there's another type of pleasantness which tends to gradually overtake the pleasantness of delicious food, pleasantness of beauty and comfort and all of that can start to be overtaken by the pleasantness of feeling like we're doing something meaningful or useful in life. And gradually that becomes the leading, that which leads us on. Now we talked about samadhi. And for insight to, for real clarity to happen, there has to be a continuity of mindfulness. The mind has to be somewhat still so that mindfulness is able to really sink into our experience and experience it beyond the superficial. But for samadhi to arise, you can't just tell yourself, now I'm going to be peaceful. Even if you go off into a cave somewhere with no other distractions, you sit down thinking, now I'll be peaceful because I don't have any distractions. Well, we carry our mind with us. You can't force yourself just to be peaceful. But there are causes and conditions which will lead to the mind calming down. Right? So these five hindrances that we experience in meditation, you go on a meditation retreat, you start to experience all the things which are blocking peace of mind. Right? To some extent, we experience peace of mind, but then even more so, we start to notice the things which are getting in the way of peace of mind and start to notice the connection between past conversations, past actions that we've done, and our current state of mind. And then we start to understand the causal relationship between our actions and our speech and our happiness or unhappiness here and now, or our peace or lack of peace here and now. So this gets into the whole area of what we call sila, or in English we call morality or behavior, wholesome behavior. So generally, if we're really paying attention to what we're doing, then there are certain types of actions and certain types of motivations which will lead to peace and happiness and contentment more readily, and certain types of behaviors and motivations and speech which will generally lead to stirring up the mind, regret, suffering, anger, a whole range of unhelpful emotions. Is everyone here familiar with five precepts? Anyone not know what five precepts are? So, okay, this is a basic moral standard that the Buddha gave. Say, at least try to do this, so we don't make any obvious bad karma. First is not intentionally killing any living being, humans or animals. Second is not intentionally stealing. Third is not misbehaving in the area of sexual relations. For example, if we have a partner, if we're married and not having affairs, or that's a very powerful area around relationships and respecting the power and commitment that you may have to your partner, and not using it in a way that which would cause harm to another person. Not intentionally lying or telling a mistruth, and then not taking intoxicants. The fifth one, not taking intoxicants, is especially important because we work so hard to develop this clarity of attention, clarity of mindful awareness moment by moment. And we can really spend a lot of time and effort refining that, and that can be undone relatively easily, unfortunately, with intoxicants. And so these are guidelines. The Buddha gives us this as guidelines to experiment with. I mean, if you trust the Buddha, you just say, okay, fine, I'll follow these precepts. But they're designed so that we learn about ourselves. Because even with clear guidelines like this, there's always gray areas when we start to look, well, what is the cause and effect relationship? Let's say, I mean, something simple like killing. If we intentionally kill an animal, what's the effect on our mind? At the time, that's sometimes when we're young, we go fishing, hunting, following in the footsteps of our fathers, grandfathers, and at the time it might be kind of maybe we don't have any negative memory of it at the time, or negative experience. But then when we meditate, it may come back, you know, and certainly I've had that experience. Or just noticing the cause and effect relationship between there are times maybe when we've lied and we can justify telling a lie in certain situations, but then that may have an effect on level of trust that we have with our friends or family and the karmic, the results that come from that, right? Times that I've stolen. I mean, when I was a teenager, I stole things sometimes. And just at the time, it was almost like a challenge. And I thought, and if when I was successful, I mean, I wasn't a thief, but, you know, it was positive. It was almost like, great, I got away with that. And then later in meditation it would come up and think, I just feel a sense of regret. And it was just natural. It wasn't guilt. I mean, there's guilt is one thing. Guilt is something that we tend to add on that doesn't need to be there. But there's also just a natural sense of regret that comes from, oh, yeah, that wasn't a nice thing to do, or that wasn't or what I said hurt someone else's feelings, or what I said maybe was conducive to someone else feeling unpleasant emotions. And I could have said something different. I could have done it in a different way, which would have been better. And so in this way, then we can reflect on our actions and our speech and see what type of actions and speech lead to feeling calm, centered, balanced, peaceful. What type of actions and speech lead to the opposite? It's pretty much impossible to have insight if we don't keep a good level of ethical behavior. If we don't maintain good ethical behavior, it's like we create the karmic obstacles to block real peace of mind. And without real peace of mind, it's very difficult to see things as they actually are. But do you have any thoughts on the relationship between behavior and insight? Well, I'm pretty clear that it's impossible for people who have an advanced level of enlightenment to have unethical behavior. So I think sometimes the term enlightenment can be used maybe a bit too loosely, but at least in the way that the Buddha strictly used it, once you attain even the first level of enlightenment, it's impossible to intentionally have a bad or to engage in breaking the five precepts, right? So your behavior becomes quite pure. So that's one thing. It is possible that people can have a fairly good level of samadhi and be good meditators, but with that, they carry around their blind spots. So that's why in practice, it's so important to take the whole well-rounded package. Because if we focus just on one part of it, if we focus just on mindfulness, that's good, but it's not the whole package. And if we focus just on samadhi, that's good, but you know, it's not the whole package. And then unfortunate things can happen. Right? So like if the emphasis is mainly just on meditation, but sila, or ethical behavior, isn't really talked about or emphasized, then people can, you can get into all sorts of twisted ways of looking at, oh, you know, people can start to overestimate themselves, especially with a little bit of samadhi and maybe some insight, not enlightened insight, but, you know, some self-knowledge and understanding. People can overestimate where they're at and then feel like, hey, everything's okay. No matter what I do, my mind is pure. It's just the body moving. You know, I am. We should not be attached to conventional reality. Therefore, conventional forms of morality don't really apply to my liberated mind. And so any teachers who start thinking in those terms can really get themselves into a lot of trouble. Or they just create a lot of confusion for other students, right? For some of them, it may be less a problem for them individually, but it really creates a confusing example for people who are beginning the path.
That's one of the things I like about your lineage is the expectations for the teachers are very clear. And coming from a Tibetan tradition when I was younger, they might have said what you just said, that the teacher can't do anything unethical. That can be used as a double-edged sword, too, because it could mean that their apparently unethical behavior is therefore ethical. And I have definitely heard that presented, you know, from very respected teachers. So I don't want to go down that rabbit hole. I'll say no more. But it's a big subject, yeah.
Yeah, it's a big subject. And even in the relatively brief history of American Buddhism, you already have run into enough situations where you see, oh, actually basic level of sila is pretty important. Because often we'll come to Buddhism maybe because it seems intelligent, it seems profound, we want to be wise, but the actual sila part seems so mundane, you know, let's not get bogged down in conventional levels of reality. And then, after a few decades, you see, well, actually it's quite practical. Yeah. And, you know, and it just saves, when you start to see the pain that can go around in a community when ethical standards are not maintained, then you realize, oh, there is a connection between ethical behavior and happiness, ethical lack of ethical behavior and suffering. Sometimes Americans, we can become puritanical about ethical behavior or go to extremes, either throw it out the window or become really kind of overly judgmental. You know, it's like if someone, and I don't notice that in, I certainly don't notice that in Thailand. Thai is a pretty laid back. You know, if they have good ethical behavior, then that's good, it's respected. Sometimes they have, they don't have good ethical behavior, but they don't feel, there's not a sense of judgment. You know, it's not a heavy sense of judgment either way. And so it is one thing that I notice is maybe a characteristic that comes from the history of the founding religious orders who have, you know, it's kind of carried on in our culture that we tend to go to those extremes, either being like overly harsh and judgmental towards people when they break their ethical standards, or we just throw it out the window and say, oh, it's not important, it's just conventional reality. So within the midst of that, there's like, hey, no one's perfect here. No one is expecting everyone to be perfect. But, you know, we can try our best because it really does make a difference.
I've really noticed for myself that the more I am mindful, the easier it is to have sila, to be ethical. So it isn't like a rule. It's you begin to see the causes, the effects of what you're doing. So it's less, you know, about, oh, am I right or am I wrong? Mm-hmm. It's, wow, if I do this, could have all these consequences that I didn't intend. So for me, the more I've become mindful, the easier it's become mm-hmm. to be ethical. When people kind of talk about mindfulness as separate from the ethics, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me, because that's where the better quality of life comes from, is that connection, for mm-hmm. me anyway.
Right. Yeah, I fully agree. And with this, a continuity of awareness, we start to see the cause and effect relationships automatically. We start to notice, oh, when I do this, that tends to reduce the trust with my partner. And that has other than consequences that create disharmony, etc. But when I do this, that tends to increase a sense of trust with my friends, my partners, my family. That tends to create harmony, happiness for everybody, right? And then, you know, our minds will incline towards happiness. I mean, it's just natural. We will incline towards happiness, and the Dhamma is set up so that we will naturally incline towards a more satisfying happiness if we give ourselves the chance. And if we care about ourselves and we care about the people around us, then we're going to naturally see, oh, I don't want to do anything that's going to harm myself. I don't want to create suffering for myself, or I don't want to do things that are going to create suffering for other people. And then naturally that adjusts, you know, our behavior and our speech adjusts. Right? So that's why it kind of all is so intertwined. It's very difficult to try to take one aspect of the Dhamma and leave the rest behind, because it's so intertwined. I mean, it already takes a lot of wisdom just to see the benefit of sila, right? Because it's not just about rule following. There's not that much. Well, there is some benefit in that, right? It's like if someone, if the Buddha tells us, don't kill, and we just do that blindly, well, there is some benefit in that. You know, we're not creating any bad karma from killing, so there's benefit. But there is a lot of wisdom to be gained just from watching that cause and effect relationship between everything that we say. There's motivation, speech, motivation and action, watching the results. How does that affect? How does that bounce back on us? How does that affect the people around us? Right? All of this requires a heightened awareness.
I was wondering, because you're a Buddhist monk and a former student of theology, because often so much of this has a practical psychological benefit, Buddhist practices, and it seems to be being co-opted more and more by the consumer culture as kind of a performance optimization or mindfulness in the boardroom or spa meditation to reduce wrinkles and Zen cereal.
Hey,
and
it works.
Yeah, your testimony to the beauty secrets of the Dhamma. And so at any rate, I understand how it's not a religion, and maybe this is just a word, but from your perspective, where do you call it a spiritual practice?
Yeah.
When see that line between the ethical and the highest expression of morality, and then this other realm that I'll call spiritual.
Yeah, it definitely is one of the current questions around, especially in the whole Vipassana / mindfulness area, because even within a few decades, it's gone from a small number of people who have trained intensively in Asia coming back and sharing their experience and teaching another generation to now where you can just get into mindfulness really without much meditation experience and see it as a wholesome career. This is my career. And I can survive this way and can be a life coach and we just take these basic principles and bring them into the mainstream. And it may be good. It can be both good and very commercial, right? And it's hard. Once we're relying on any aspects of Dhamma to be our income, it's hard not to have it's that affect what we teach. Right? You get into performance optimization. I just gave, it was Father's Day recently, I gave my father a book called Sacred Hoops, you know, which is essentially Phil Jackson, a very successful basketball coach in the NBA, had used mindfulness training as one of his secrets to leading the Chicago Bulls to their success in the mid-90s, right? So, kind of a neat way to bring that into my dad's world, but in one sense, it seems totally divorced from spiritual. You know, it's just about we're going to win, we're going to make more money. And how can we do that? If we can get an edge on the competition, then we're going to be the best. And so that's how even the best aspects of the Dhamma can be polluted by defilements. You know, you can take even the best aspects of any part of the Noble Eightfold Path and transform them into something which is completely worldly and materialistic. Having said that, those basketball players, having practiced even some mindfulness in that way, that may have had a positive influence on their life, right? So that they may have looked at things from a perspective they may never have looked at before, and may have learned more about themselves. Certainly, it helped and it transformed them in some way, right? So I can't say it's an entirely bad thing. Hot issue these days is teaching mindfulness in the military. Now, the generals or whoever brought it in, they were probably thinking more in terms of performance enhancement. Whereas the teachers, the actual mindfulness teachers who bring it in, saying, hey, look, we have no intention of creating better killers. Our intention is to alleviate suffering. And if we're talking about stress reduction, people in war zones have a tremendous amount of stress, so let's not exclude them, right? Even soldiers are, soldiers are people too, right? And so why should we exclude those people from having access to mindfulness teachings? And it may make them more reflective, it may actually reduce mistakes. I mean, in war, collateral damage is kind of a part of war because people panic. And they just make bad decisions. Maybe if they were more clear-headed, there would be less collateral damage. So you got both sides of it, right? And then I was talking to some of the teachers who were involved in that, and they said, look, you know, we talk to soldiers kind of in the same way we'll talk to retreatants, and let them come to their own conclusions. And some of them will say, look, they say, hey, if we really practice this, then we can't really intentionally kill people, can we? And so let them come to their own conclusions. So in, I don't have a strong opinion about the mainstreaming of mindfulness. I appreciate that it's going mainstream. It doesn't bother me that they are not using any Buddhist terms. It'd be nice, well, it'd be nice if they gave the Buddha credit at some point, but really, anyone who delves into it a little bit will realize that, you know, very quickly it comes back to Theravada tradition. And even if people have no idea that it has any Buddhist connection, if it alleviates suffering in the world, then this is a good thing. Even if people are making money from it, but it helps people, say it's a good thing. But it may not be the best, you know. There's more to it than that. And that's why, you know, I just find it so important to keep coming back to it. Look, it's a whole package. Anytime you just take one part of it and emphasize that out of proportion to the whole lifestyle, then it's not going to quite work. It will work a little bit, but it's not going to quite work. Hopefully it works enough that people will then become interested to take up, to see how it's all interrelated. It's a whole life.
I'm curious if Buddha had a collective social agenda.
You mean like an online calendar?
Pardon?
What do you mean?
Because at an individual level, it's great for military people to be mindful. It's great for everybody to be mindful. So where do we come together around this capacity that we are enhancing, which is natural? Is there a goal to this? And I'll throw this out in a more open way. What does American Buddhism want to be? I mean, we got a big opportunity, right? So I'll just throw that out. If that isn't too far off topic.
Well, I don't think... I think everyone's just finding out as we go. And it's already going into places that people didn't expect it to, you know, 20 years ago. So in a sense, it's quite encouraging that it's going mainstream. Maybe it's a bit discouraging that it's getting watered down. It's encouraging that so many different traditions are all mingling. I mean, it's totally unprecedented in the 2,500-year history of Buddhism that we have access to the wisdom teachings of all these different traditions simultaneously, and it's all mixing. So that's very... Well, no one's quite sure what's going to happen with that. I mean, people are experimenting. I think generally it will be a positive thing, but that's, in a historical perspective, that's quite radical. You know, we're not separated by geography in the way that we used to be. So where it's all heading, it's all going down the tubes. I don't think, you know, it's, America is so varied and the Dhamma scene is so varied equally, it's tough to make generalizations. But, you know, you take a look at a place like Common Ground as an example. It's very encouraging, isn't it? You know, 15 years ago when I first met Mark, it was just a tiny little mom-pop organization out of his living room, you know? And then now it's this big, thriving community, so much benefit coming out of a place like this, hundreds, thousands of people being involved. You know, it's really inspiring. And it's great to be part of something like that. Great to support, great to encourage, great to have a community, you know, that is dedicated to benefit of one and the positive social ripples that go out from that. But, you know, everything's a permanent. 10 years from now, the whole thing could collapse. You know, enjoy it while you can. It's great now.
And if we have some volunteers at the end, we're putting a big billboard up on top of the building.
Yeah, right. Neon advertisements.
10% off for the month of August. Get your enlightenment cheap.
Enlightenment was $4.99, now $3.99 while the offer lasts. Limited time.
If you pay today, you get a photograph with Ajahn. A selfie.
A non-selfie. Okay. I want to touch on some of other aspects of causes for insight, kind of foundation-building causes of insight that may not be so obvious. For example, I'll just bring this up, and maybe we can talk about it as we go. There's a lot of Dhamma qualities that are indirectly very helpful and sometimes indispensable. One is generosity, right? You know, generosity, what we mean by generosity is that whole movement of the mind to help somebody else out, yeah? To whether it's giving material, or whether it is giving time, whether it is giving someone attention, whether it's just being there for somebody, patient, giving them kindness and compassion. I mean, this is all just that the movement of the mind just to give brings us away from the self-centered habits. How can we help somebody else out? How can we be of benefit? Right? So indirectly, that's very helpful for developing insight. I've noticed in meditators, like serious meditators over the last 25, 30 years that I've been involved with it, that having a positive outlook in life is actually very helpful. Often in Asia, I'll have run into very intelligent but somewhat cynical meditators who are like, yeah, you know, life's a piece of shit, man. You know, just meditate, let it all go. And, you know, just let it go. It's worthless. Samsara is worthless. And, you know, they're kind of a downer to be around. And that would be okay if it really worked. But, you know, watching people over a series of decades, it's like, you know, having that kind of attitude towards letting go or that type of attitude towards renunciation just doesn't work very well. It doesn't really seem to lead to balance and being peaceful and happy. So, but generally, the people that I've seen who have been very, I would say, successful or been able to really achieve a sense of peace and balance over a sustained period of time, who tend to be quite wise, they generally have developed quite a positive outlook of life, realistically, not unrealistic, but a realistic outlook to see where there's beauty, you appreciate beauty, and then let it go. You know, where there's pleasantness, you appreciate pleasantness, and then let it go. Right? And where things are unpleasant, you notice that, but you let that go. And all of the wise people I've met are very joyous. You know, there's a real joy that is expressed in their behavior and the way they live, which can sometimes be surprising. If you just read about the First Noble Truth, so the First Noble Truth is suffering. Buddhism sounds quite depressing, quite negative. You just look at all of the negative things in life so you don't get attached to those. But ironically, the results of mindfully, honestly looking at life is that we tend to become happier and happier, and the natural joy just starts to bubble up by itself. And without that joy, it's almost impossible to develop samadhi. Right? Without samadhi, then it's very difficult to develop insight. I guess one thing which follows on from that is honestly acknowledging the suffering in our own lives. And I noticed this just coming to America on this trip and spending time with friends, relatives, maybe non-Buddhist practitioners. Often you ask them how they're doing. I mean, I can see their life. We ask them how they're doing. They think, great, or fine. Everything's fine. How are you? I'm fine. How's your life? Oh, it's wonderful. But it's actually quite obvious that they're experiencing suffering. Either they're angry, or they have a short temper. Things make them angry easily, or maybe there's disharmony with friends or partners, but there's a real reluctance to admit that. And that reluctance to admit the difficulties in life are often the things that block the insight. You know, it's like we can't let go of something. We can't really open up and let go of something until we admit that it exists. Right? I don't know if people have any experience with that. One thing which tends to be noticeable when I come to visit America is people can have attachment to opinions, maybe political opinions, it may be opinions about anything. Opinions about what's right and wrong, positive, you know, what is the proper way to live one's life. Opinions about our groups, opinions about other ethnic groups, opinions about how to run the country, opinions about guns. And there's nothing wrong with opinions, but when we have strong attachment to opinions, that will tend to be a block for insight. It just kind of happens that if we have a very strong attachment to an opinion, we don't see things in a well-rounded way. Right? So, of course, as human beings, we will have opinions. We experience life from that. We interpret certain things, and then we develop a view of our reality and opinions based on that. I mean, the Buddha still had opinions. The Buddha still had view. I mean, the first aspect of the Noble Eightfold Path is right view. And it's not that the Buddha said don't have any views, don't have, you know, it wasn't a relativism. But the Buddha said, well, there are certain views which are more in line with reality. And then as we become more wise, our opinions, our perceptions, our views all become gradually transformed to be more in line with reality. So generally, it's a good thing to keep in mind even when we feel impassioned about something. Just, okay, well, where is this coming from? And how attached am I to this view, this opinion? Right? If we and what are the benefits of that may motivate us to, you know, try to overcome injustice, but also what are the drawbacks of having impassioned opinions that, well, tends to throw the mind off balance. So then how can we engage with wise opinions but still maintain, you know, a wise relationship with our views and opinions and perceptions? So with walking meditation, there in the time of the Buddha, there seems to be no emphasis on walking slowly. That's simply one Burmese technique. And in the forest tradition, it just depends on your particular state of mind and what is helpful. Generally, we find it helpful to walk at a normal pace. Maybe, you know, you don't have to be running, but, you know, slightly, you know, kind of a normal pace, a relaxed pace. And you may also find that if you're really low energy, you want to walk a bit faster because that brings up energy. Like if you're really feeling sleepy or tired at the end of a day, if you sit down after a hard day's work, you try to meditate, maybe fall asleep really easily, you know, just do a bit of, you know, walking meditation at this speed. Before you know it, you're feeling pretty awake and alert. You also might find that if the mind is very scattered, that you start walking a bit faster and gradually slow down. That will help bring you kind of, that helps the mind to calm down as well. Now, it is natural if you're feeling extremely calm and peaceful, it feels uncomfortable to walk fast. So naturally, you just start, you know, if you're feeling really peaceful, it just feels great to walk like this. But don't force yourself to walk like that. Just walk at a natural pace.
Sometimes I'll feel my feet going down, feel the sensations, but then I alternate between sounds, and then I'll just, for like 5 minutes, and then I'll feel my hand, and then I'll go back to my feet, and then sound for 5 minutes, and then just feeling my hand for 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. Is that okay?
That is fine, yeah. Basically, anything that's happening in the present moment, if you're maintaining a general awareness without getting too drawn into complication, mm-hmm. you know, a sight, a sound, sensations in part of the body, that's fine. At some point, it's natural that we become a bit more systematic, okay. Right? But that's fine, what you described.
Do you have a thought on where to cast the eyes as you're walking?
Generally, kind of look at the path a couple yards ahead in an unfocused gaze, or just generally kind of look ahead. So there's a periphery awareness, so we don't walk into trees or other people or across the street and get hit by a car. You know, there's a periphery awareness, but the main focus is not to be looking at something. And kind of keep the awareness around here. So it's the thing with walking meditation, even though it's, you know, we talk a lot about paying attention to the movement of the body and the feet, it's really an exercise with seeing and our relationship with seeing. Because after so much time sitting with meditation with our eyes closed, suddenly our eyes are open. It's like, now what? It's like, boom, so much stimulation from perceptions and colors and shapes. And okay, can I still maintain the sense of being relatively centered? You see something without the attention being drawn out. You know, can I see something without a whole story arising from that? Or if it does, just recognizing, oh, okay, well, that's what happens. You know, come back and start again. But yeah, you notice, if you see somebody doing a walking meditation, they're like, you know, And you know, okay, well, maybe that's not the most mindful. All right, so I guess we can walk either inside or around the grounds. We'll go for half hour, and we'll ring the bell somehow to let people know to come back in. Continuing on with some of the causes and conditions leading to insight. One thing which may not be immediately obvious, but which is very helpful, is developing the quality of contentment. Contentment may seem like a quality that we would experience at the end of our spiritual practice, at the end of Dhamma practice, once we're enlightened, then we'll be content. But you can actually start practicing contentment from the very beginning, and it's very helpful. And just this whole question of how much stuff do we need to be happy? The question of stuff and the question of activity, how much activity? The question of the people that we have around us. What is contentment? Do we have everything we need to be happy right here and right now? And if logically we can look, well, I have enough food, I have shelter, I have a reasonably stable social position in my family and society. Basically, we have everything we need to be happy here and now. So then, what would get in the way of that? Why would we not be perfectly content right here and right now? Or just looking at, you know, this whole question of how much do we need to be content? Or appreciating what we have to foster a sense of contentment. Now, contentment doesn't mean we're complacent, especially in the with Dhamma practice. You can be content with what we have, but at the same time be motivated to develop further, you know, devoted to developing the wholesome and perfecting the wholesome, taking it further. But you know, again, it's one of those balances where be content with what we have here and now, and yet maybe not aspire, maybe even have some social or material aspirations. That's not necessarily bad. But can we do that and at the same time be content with what we have right now? So that's very helpful, because the mind that is not content, discontent, it's very difficult to see things clearly. Very difficult to get insight and see things as they truly are when we're experiencing discontent. Now, another quality which is very helpful is quality of, in Pali we call it kalyanamitta, or true friends. Now, the Buddha defines kalyanamitta in a variety of ways. Ultimately, The best kalyanamitta is the Buddha himself, as a good friend, someone who is worthy of your trust, worthy of our trust, who can lead us along, guide us and encourage us along a path of practice leading to greater happiness and ultimately nibbana. With the Buddha no longer being alive, then it's very helpful to have teachers, maybe teachers who are a bit more experienced than we are, that can then be an example and a source of encouragement, sometimes a source of inspiration to follow in their footsteps and continuing on, bringing up motivation to practice the Dhamma. Even if we don't have teachers, or even if we do have teachers, then it's very helpful to have supportive friends. Like just getting together with a community to help a like-minded community. There's so much in our society which is pulling us away from a Dhamma perspective, encouraging greed, encouraging anger, definitely encouraging delusion. So it's helpful. It's very helpful to have friends who we can trust and who are supportive of similar aspirations. So sometimes we might overlook the importance of that. I mean, sometimes people go to the opposite extreme and they overemphasize that and say, well, if I've got my guru, then everything will be fine. And then just they don't really take responsibility for the rest of their practice. And that's not correct either. But having a group of true friends, people who we can rely on, who share our aspirations, will be very helpful for developing all of the rest of the causes, which will then be leading to insight. Similarly, we are affected by our environment. We touched on this a bit last night with Curtis's question of, the Buddha's encouragement to spend time with wise people, and if you have the opportunity, avoiding fools and spending time in supportive environments. And if you have the choice, then avoiding environments which are going to be bringing up or stimulating defilements. So we all have some room for navigation in this, without being overly controlling, or overly obsessive about it. It's like, we are affected and conditioned by our environment and the people we spend time with, so it is worth paying attention to and noticing how that affects us. And then when we can, spending time generally in natural environments, or even if we're in the city, just less chaotic environments. I mean, you can be in the countryside and have a very chaotic little social situation in the countryside, and that's not very peaceful either. So no matter what the environment is, just watching the effect that it has on us. Is it giving rise to the wholesome states? Is it encouraging? Are wholesome states getting stronger? Or are wholesome states beginning to diminish? And often that is the best standard that we can have for should we stay here or should we go? Should we be with this teacher or that teacher? Should we be in this tradition or that tradition? Should we be in the country or the city? Well, just see, are wholesome states increasing or are wholesome states decreasing? Right? Again, it comes back to recognition of what is wholesome and what is unwholesome, which comes back to really paying attention. We just have to watch our minds, observe all the time. Does anybody have any thoughts on any of those subjects?
Yeah, you talk about like being content, and then also you can be motivated to develop further. I'm not sure if I could really articulate my question, but so currently my practice, so I'm kind of in a state where I feel like I'm kind of stuck. I feel like I'm not really making any more progress. So in the beginning, I mean, for example, like I went to this meditation retreat like about 2 years ago, and ever since that meditation retreat, like added more time to my meditation. I've been meditating 30 minutes every morning. But in the beginning, I noticed, I feel like, I feel like I'm more aware. I'm usually very, very distracted. I'm still a distracted person, but I kind of feel like I could feel the benefit right away. But then, especially these days, like I find myself, sometimes I sleep through the whole meditation time, sometimes I'm just, preoccupied with all different thoughts and just follow my delusion. And I'm kind of back and forth, I don't need to be attached to like this good meditation, so called, you know, like peaceful. But at the same time, I want to improve more, and then kind of, you know, find myself attached to the idea. I want to be, you know, I want to have all feel the benefit better. You know, I want to reach that state again. So. I don't know, but I'm kind of in that state. Do you have any advice for me if I was clear on, you know, where I am?
It's okay when things aren't dramatically improving. Right? It's not necessarily a sign that we're doing anything wrong. Sometimes, I mean, all the time, patience is very important. We can't force ourselves to develop at any particular rate. Even if we're very motivated, we can't force ourselves to develop insights or samadhi any faster than they're naturally going to come. But you can check to see, okay, well, has anything changed? Is there anything I can do to develop more interest in the meditation? If you find that meditation is starting to become boring and you're falling asleep, is it because you're falling asleep because it's boring, or you're falling asleep because you're physically tired, you know, after either in the morning or the evening? Either way, you know, there's adjustments we can make. If meditation starts to becoming boring, try a different meditation. There's so many different types of meditation. You know, try something new. Brings up interest. It's a bit more challenging. When there's challenge and interest and energy is there and we're awake, right, then it's easy to be concentrated because we're interested in it. If we're not interested in it, then we just zone out or we think about something else. So experiment. There's so many different types. If you're doing breath meditation, and you kind of lose the edge on that, great, well, start taking up mindfulness of death. That'll get our awareness. You know, start contemplating death. If you want to start systematically developing metta, loving kindness, or karuna, compassion, right, do that. If you want to start systematically investigating the nature of the body, and all of the different parts of the body, right? That will keep you awake. So there's a whole range of things that we can do to kind of come at Dhamma from a different angle. Yeah. There's so many different aspects of Dhamma. It's never just about like one particular technique or one particular aspect. And any time Dhamma starts to feel a bit stale, then just focus on a different part of it. Right? It's like a whole integrated lifestyle. And if nothing else, if nothing seems to be working at all, then just do generosity, right? Generosity is like the gasoline that gets our vehicle going. You know, just find, you know, if you're feeling like nothing's working, no motivation, no progress, kind of stuck, then just look for areas to be generous. You know, helping some, how can I help somebody else out? What can I do? What can I give? You know, and that karmically, that just kind of gets, that's fuel. That gets the whole thing moving again.
I normally am not really good at following the breath. I tend to be better at open awareness. And I sat down for a half hour sit, and there was like five thoughts in a half hour. And my mind gladly went to the breath. And when I got done, I was like, I didn't do that. It felt so different than any experience I've ever had. You know, my mind is usually filled with thoughts, and I keep coming back over and over and over. Mm-hmm. And when I do try to stay on the breath, it's an effort, but this was no effort. And like five thoughts in a half hour. Mm-hmm.
So when you're done with the meditation like that, And you think, you know, it's good to spend a little time renewing, reviewing, and then check. Did I do anything different leading into that? Was there any difference in what I ate, how much I slept, my interaction with other people? Was there anything that I can detect that might have been different than normal? You know, if so, then we think, oh well, maybe there's some causal connection there that we can then learn from. Yeah. I mean, I noticed that when I eat less than I want, my meditation is better. So in Thailand, I would often, you know, just limit how much I ate, or if I would just, I would notice, oh, meditation seems really good tonight. And I remember, oh, I ate less this morning. Right? Remember, you make that connection, and then you realize, you know, the quality of our meditation is the result of many different causes and conditions. Not just effort, not just the effort we're making while we sit there, yeah, but everything kind of leading up to it.
Right, I thought there was no effort when I was there.
Right, and
which is new for me. It was the second week of a 2-week retreat.
Right, and so the first week may have been the cause and condition for that to happen, right? So it doesn't just come out of nowhere. You know, it's like all of the persistence and effort in bringing the mind back, starting over, being persistent, bringing it back, the mind wanders, bringing it back, and then kind of may just come into balance at some point, and it just feels effortlessness. Now, it doesn't mean that the previous effort was wrong. It may mean that we can adjust our relationship with effort so that, I mean, some people try too hard and that gets in the way, but it's not the case that effortlessness is always the way, because, you know, sometimes we do need to, you know, consciously place our attention on certain things, consistently break old bad habits and create new good habits, and, you know, that's okay. But then at some point, it starts to feel very natural. It starts to become the default. Yeah? And then it can feel more natural, effortless.
I had an experience. Well, I wouldn't call it experience. Everything's an experience. But in walking meditation when I was outside, I was trying to find a spot, you know, to do my walking. And I thought, oh, well, I really would like some shade. But I saw that all the shady spots had been taken up.
Yeah, and so, dang people.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a conspiracy, undoubtedly. Yeah.
I'd be happy if it wasn't for all these darn people.
Yeah. So then I realized that I had some aversion going. And you know, the aversion was still there. You know, I started walking.
Did you just, like, push them out of the way?
Yeah.
I'm walking here.
I didn't even give that any thought. I really should have given that some thought. So what I noticed that as I was walking, that I, you know, they still had this aversion to, man, it's hot. But and I thought, wait a minute, now, this is warm. This is warm. And then I noticed, you know, later on, this is a cool breeze. You know, and then as I also noticed that I kind of like this pace of walking. It was more like what you had suggested, more at the normal pace. And I thought, oh, I think I could probably keep this up for a while. And then I start feeling the contentment, you know, starting to come on. And I know that there was an adverse thought that came up prior to that I don't think I could ever do this all day or walk all day or walk several hours. You know, it's maybe the most I've ever walked is an hour, but I thought maybe it's possible. Yeah. So.
Yeah. So that's a very good example of if we sometimes force ourselves to do, or someone else forces us to do things which we normally wouldn't do. You know, we would seek out the comfortable way to do it, or the pleasant place to do something, and then for some reason we're forced to do it in an unpleasant or less comfortable place or time, then suddenly we're stuck with, I could either be discontent or I could learn how to make peace with this. And there's one of the early suttas of the Buddha, you know, he talks about these excuses that monks have for not meditating. You say, it's too hot to meditate, right? You know, it's too hot to meditate. I'll meditate when it's cooler. And then other times, it's too cold to meditate. You know, like I wake up in the morning, it's too cold to meditate. You know? Or other times, it's too early to meditate. Or it's too late to meditate. I'm too tired to meditate. I'm too sick to meditate. You know, and eventually it's like, I'm too old to meditate. And then you're dead. So it's... Ajahn Chah was a master at pushing people out of their comfort zone. I mean, this was his meditation technique. The Ajahn Chah meditation technique was just pushing people outside of their comfort zone. And because people loved him so much, he could get away with it. But it was difficult for people because he was so good at tuning into exactly what people wanted. And he would just not give it to them. You know? So it was just so...
And he had fun doing it.
Oh, he had a great time. Everyone else had a great time watching because they could kind of... They know that, this person, is dedicated but really doesn't like to go anywhere else. He's kind of attached to his own little scene there. And I think it'd be great if you went off to this little branch monastery in the countryside. And everyone else kind of... the people who are really anxious to go off wandering on Tudong, the wandering practice, and want to be in the forest, he's like, well, you should just stay here. Can I go into it? No, I think it's better if you just stay here. Or sometimes he would just be giving a Dhamma talk, and he would just keep going and going and going, and he could talk for hours and hours. And he kept telling, he'd tell old stories that he's told before and just as an excuse to keep talking. And, people are getting really painful and uncomfortable because in Thailand you have to sit on a concrete floor. And, you can't squirm too much because it's impolite while he's giving a Dhamma talk. I mean, this was before my time, but, I had plenty of experience of that with other teachers. And just hearing what it was like with Ajahn Chah, and particularly sometimes he would just intentionally keep talking and talking and talking so that people would feel all of this physical discomfort and they would have to learn how to make peace with that. And at a certain stage, they're no longer listening to what he's saying. They're just feeling all of the pain in their body from sitting there and learning how to deal with that and paying attention to that. And he knew that. And he could get away with pushing people outside the comfort zone, pushing people past where they would normally take themselves. If it was just up to them, I mean, generally, if it's just up to us, we think, this much is reasonable, but beyond that is not reasonable. That's unreasonable, so we're not going to do that to ourselves. But then when a teacher forces us, to go beyond, think this is really unreasonable. This is unreasonable. The mind's going, this is not the middle way. This is unreasonable. This is extreme asceticism. This is not, no. He's doing this on purpose. It's a conspiracy. Or just the mind complaining. And we realize, I'm creating this. Right? Yes, there is unpleasant physical sensation, but I'm creating this whole story around it that is unnecessary. And that's the point. you know, the Ajahn Chah is trying to get across. Get pushed out of your comfort zone. Can you still be content and peaceful? You know? Doing walking meditation in the sunshine on a hot day. We wouldn't choose to do that. But when we do, oh, actually, it's okay. And then often it's particularly when we overcome a challenge or if we learn how to be content with something that we didn't really want to do, that it leads to other things opening up. What you said was a good example of that. Next retreat you do with Mark, he's going to be really tough. Yeah.
Sitting. It takes a lot of confidence for a teacher to be willing to push people out of their comfort zone.
Yeah. You have to be willing to be... You have to be willing to have people be angry at you.
I'm not there yet.
I mean,
that's out of my comfort zone.
Right, exactly. See, it's good for you.
Yeah.
But having said that, you know, it's good to know who can get away with it and who can't. Ajahn Chah could get away with it, one, because everyone was pretty confident he was an arhat. Fully enlightened being. Two, he just had this personality that everyone just loved him. And so, you know, people loved him and then, oh, I can't believe he's making us do that, but you still love him, right? It does. And then when we first started Wat Banana Cha at the International Forest Monastery for Westerners, sometimes the Western teachers would try to imitate Ajahn Chah and it didn't work, right? You try to push other Westerners outside their comfort zone, they tell you where to get off. Who do you think you are? You think you're Ajahn Chah? Yeah? Try to pull that on me. All right. So, yeah, it's obviously you have to. You have to know your limits.
I'll start with our cat. Push it out of its comfort zone.
All right. Exactly.
That poor cat.
Outside the door. Yeah. Next year when I do a all-day workshop, we can just sit meditation in the parking lot in the open sun. Oh, God, that would be great, wouldn't it? See how many people last the whole day.
I don't think you're supposed to tell them.
Oh, ahead of time. Oh, yeah, the registration is like, the registration drops considerably. Why has the registration dropped considerably since last year? Here's another aspect of Dhamma practice that people may not immediately associate with insight. Is faith in one's own ability. Right? If you don't really have confidence that you can do it, probably won't happen. Right? Yeah, it has to at least be the faith that this is possible for me. Right? And this is something Forest Masters would regularly say because often our meditation masters often seem so exalted, but they would regularly try to emphasize that the great masters were once just as stupid as you are. You know? And somehow that's comforting. It's like, okay, well, even in my kind of relatively confused, deluded state. I have the same natural ability. I have the same potential as the arhats. I have the same potential of awakening as the Buddha. And what's the difference? The difference is mainly effort, time and effort. Yeah. We all come into life with different degrees of natural potential or inclination in certain areas. Some people are naturally good at certain areas, skills. We all have varying degrees of skill in Dhamma practice. But we all have the same degree of potential. And we all definitely have the potential to improve tremendously, even within one lifetime. And this is important to keep in mind, because otherwise we psych ourselves out. Just by believing that, I could never do that. It's too exalted for me. We don't realize, we actually have that potential. And then at least we have the opportunity to try to realize some of that potential. Patience is a big part of it. One of the classic things that you just run up to again and again with Dhamma practices is patience and the importance of patience. Patience is one of the 10 paramitas or paramis. Kanti is the Pali term. Kanti parami is just like whatever the situation is, at least it's an opportunity for developing patience. No matter how unpleasant it is, it's an opportunity for developing patience. No matter how it seems like our Dhamma practice is going nowhere, at least if we keep at it, we're developing patience. Whether we feel satisfied with ourselves or we're dissatisfied with ourselves, at least we can try to be patient with ourselves. If we feel surrounded by irritating people, at least we can develop patience. Even if we're not at the stage where we can be all-encompassing with our compassion, unlimited, unbounded compassion, at least we can practice patience. And that develops a tremendous inner strength, which we can then, we have to rely on that, right? I mean, this is part of what Ajahn Chah would do. When he'd push people out of their comfort zone, is they would have to learn how to be patient and just kind of endure. Not endure with gritting one's teeth, but endure with wisdom. You know, we're just patiently sticking with it. This is unpleasant, I'm going to stick with it. This is unpleasant, you stick with it. Right? And that develops a lot of inner strength. But you have to be willing to go outside of your comfort zone to some degree. Yeah? If we're really stuck in our comfort zone too much, we're going to be quite limited by that. So, fortunately, life pushes us out of our comfort zone quite often, whether we want it to happen or not. It just kind of happens, either with relationships with other people or physical illnesses and physical limitations. You know, we get pushed out of our comfort zone a lot. So how do we take those unpleasant situations and turn them into something positive? And say, well, at least we can develop this quality of patience. Really being patient, accepting, not giving up, continuing on no matter whether it's easy or difficult. You just keep on going, continuing on. And it's not a flashy quality. It's not like a, wow spiritual quality. But it's actually one of the most important. And not just, I mean, we're not just talking about being patient while we're waiting in a line or being patient when we're stuck in traffic, although, you know, that's part of it. But just, you know, just this whole attitude of sticking with it. Sticking with it no matter what, being patient, not reacting with fault finding, not reacting by feeling frustrated, or if we do start to get frustrated, then just, okay, well, that's just frustration. I'll be patient with that. I'll be patient with myself when frustration arises. And then we just keep, no matter what happens, no matter what comes up, externally or internally, just develop, just keep going, keep going. Acknowledge it, be patient, accepting, let it go if we can. If we can't let it go, just be patient with it. And, yeah, over the years, you really see the benefit of that. Really develop some strength. Otherwise, we end up being quite emotionally fragile. I see that in some people. You know, just someone, it's like so fragile, someone criticizes us, then we collapse. You know, we get a criticism, and it was just like, either we're going to blow up with self-justification, or we collapse with lack of self-esteem, or, you know, it's like so fragile. Or we get pushed out of our comfort zone, and then we just kind of freak out. It's like so fragile. So it's really helpful to develop this, hey, someone praises us, fine. Someone criticizes us, fine. I mean, not fine, like we were saying, not a repressive fine, but like, oh, okay, I accept that, I acknowledge that. Maybe I can learn something from it. Just continue on, never give up, you know? And that develops a lot of inner strength. Someone agrees with our opinion, okay. Someone disagrees with our opinion, then they're wrong. No, just kidding. So there's, you know, and just seeing how, and just learning from other people. I mean, I just learn from other people when I come, and I see, you know, so people are, it's like some people I meet are, they're quite competent within their little sphere, within their little nest, and as soon as one little thing goes wrong out of their daily routine, then they kind of freak out and get upset. It's like, wow, that's a really weak position to be in. So how can we train ourselves so that no matter what happens, you know, we can deal with it, right? Buddhism is like this practice that prepares you for any eventuality in life, no matter what happens. See, okay, well, this is all part of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. If we develop a relationship with our senses, our sense world, and our perceptions, and regularly developing patience with all of that, then it just creates this real solid foundation. So no matter what happens, we're going to be ready for it.
So, emotional fragility, isn't that a quality we're cultivating?
Cultivate?
Yeah. Isn't that what we're cultivating? Or
no,
an emotional openness?
No, we can develop sensitivity. By fragility, I mean so prone to getting upset or reactive or quickly falling into self-criticism or, you know, being very open and patient and sensitive, you know, that's part of what we want to develop, yes.
I'm trying to put a whole life into perspective of moments that were terribly fragile. And I considered it my vulnerability. Not that I wasn't secure otherwise, but in that moment, things really changed, or the other person's trauma level was significant. And I was immersed in it. So I was not, I'd look back and say, my practice was inadequate. So I couldn't be there with them in that place, traumatic place, effectively. I lost myself in it. That would be, so I'm thinking that way. So it's like this, the whole question then seems to be how effective a practice I need or anybody needs to be immersed in traumatic world as a lifestyle, as a helping lifestyle. Mm-hmm. So it's, could you say more about that? I mean, where the outreach sort of effort comes in, or I don't know.
It is sometimes, it's true, sometimes our practice just isn't up to it. And we all have our limits, and that's okay. That doesn't mean we're doing anything wrong, or it doesn't mean that we're somehow flawed in our Dharma practice. But we have limits. We have limits, and sometimes very intense situations, emotionally intense or traumatic situations, it's good to understand if we're going beyond our limits. I mean, sometimes we're pushed beyond our limits and we just have to deal with it as best we can. And it can be good to try to expand the envelope, challenge ourselves. That can be very helpful. If we're regularly pushed beyond our limits, then it's like we lose perspective, right? So it's, as soon as, if we're just taken over by emotions, then we're no longer really practicing the Dhamma, right? We don't have a perspective on it. We're no longer observing. We're just taken over by a tsunami of emotion or trauma. So if we try to practice, that's what we call practice, we try to train in situations that are much less intense, normal, daily, average, ordinary situations, where we can train and strengthen these wholesome qualities of mind so that when something big does happen, we have this base, solid foundation that can help us withstand the wave and be there and be present in an authentic way, a sensitive way, without just being bowled over, without just reacting blindly.
So would it be safe to say the limits are in terms of how much of the world one can engage?
Yeah. I mean,
one has a comfort zone and one wants to challenge that, mm-hmm. oneself, but beyond that, recognizing one's limits enables one to be more attentive to one's personal challenge.
Right. I mean, it is true. People get the idea, oh, I should push myself out of the comfort zone, and then they regularly push themselves too far, mm-hmm. too often, and they get burned out. And so that's not the idea either. Right? If we push ourselves, gently push ourselves out of the comfort zone regularly, that kind of gradually expands the amount that we can take on. In my own case, for example, when I was living in Thailand as a junior monk, if I was meditating a lot in my hut, I felt I could maintain that sense of being centered and balanced, but even a little work project, and it would throw me off. Even just, like an hour of work and with conversing with other people, it would throw me off. And so, I really didn't want to do that. But not that was a wholesome reaction, but it was recognition of, even a little bit at that stage would throw me off. And then as years went on, I could gradually take on a little bit more, but I really didn't want to take on too much. And then I became an abbot, and by that time, I started to take on more and say, well, how much can I take on without feeling like I'm being drawn out? Because if we try to give too much and be too many things to too many people, that's not helpful, because then we burn out and we don't have the same amount to offer. So how can I gradually expand the envelope of what I'm able to take on? Right? And this is all part of making everything into meditation. So gradually, I could sit in a committee meeting and feel like, and not feel exhausted at the end, not feel any aversion for the committee meeting at all. Even enjoy the committee meeting and still feel like I'm developing mindful awareness the whole time. Physical work, you know, there's a in some ways doing physical work is very conducive for meditation, you know, because you're in your body, you're doing things outside, but too much, and then you just get exhausted. So I have to respect where the limits are, push it a little bit, but know when I've gone over the limit, and come back and recuperate a bit with sitting and walking meditation, a bit of time alone, right? And then speaking with other people. If you're meditating a lot and then you get into one intense conversation for an hour, it can feel exhausting. So how then to be a teacher when you're speaking with people a lot without losing the perspective, without getting burned out? So it's kind of a skill that we gradually develop of being able to engage and yet not have our energy be sucked out. Because if we, that's kind of the, we call it near enemies. Like the near enemy of compassion is you get sucked into the other person's suffering and it draws your energy out and you end up feeling depressed afterwards rather than, you know, the result of developing wholesome qualities of mind is a sense of lightness and joy, or at least a sense of compassion and wisdom arising. But like, especially in helping professions or hospice work, if people aren't really paying attention, then they can so easily just get burnt out because they're trying to help. They get drawn into other people's suffering and they end up exhausted. So it's a skill to somehow protect, maintain one's energy while still authentically being there for another person. And of course, it's a skill that we gradually develop. So in the beginning, our ability to help others and maintain a sense of progress in our own Dhamma practice is much more limited. Right? And then and you can't push ourselves too far, but we kind of gradually get better at it. Gradually able to take on more and more and more and feel like we're not, you know, we're still energized and bright and happy and feeling good about Dhamma practice. And when we do sit down to meditate, you know, it hasn't deteriorated. You know, we're still able to access states of samadhi and insight. It's a lifetime's work, you know, and where we just have to keep watching the balance, not pushing ourselves too far, not becoming overly complacent or stuck, you know, challenging somewhat, but not getting burned out.
I'll just say, I'm grateful to have found Common Ground and the sort of easy access to a significant practice, and the change it's brought about for me has been exactly that of a balance. And part of it seems to be the wisdom of learning to give that to myself, that I haven't had, I've been locked out of it, out of my own sort of desire for compassion for others. And anyway, that seems to be part of the practice as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, having compassion for yourself. Well, we're kind of getting down to the end. When we talk about the causes and conditions leading to insight, then includes almost everything. When I do teachings here at Common Ground, they like to have a title at least 6 months in advance. In and yet usually I speak spontaneously. So I have to make up a title which includes anything.
The way it is. Thank you so much, Ajahn. It was a really wonderful workshop. We got the whole path. So we're done, right? Isn't it just kind of an intellectual understanding we're looking for? Yeah.
As long as it's theoretically reasonable, we're good.
It's very clear. It seemed very clear today. Very appreciative.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you. Wish you well.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.